And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. Who's Talking, featuring interesting guests from our community on News Talk 1360 WCATL. Now, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin and my guest. Well, let me tell you about her first. She's a native of Charlotte, graduate of Duke Law School, and a former Washington lawyer who has turned to writing books. And it shouldn't be a surprise because her mama is somebody who churns out a best-selling crime novel every year. But we're going to talk to Carrie Reichs, the daughter of Kathy Reichs, about the change in her life and the challenges of writing versus the challenges of giving of the law practice that she's given up. And so, Carrie Reichs, you're visiting your family in Charlotte. Welcome back to North Carolina.
Well, thank you. It's always nice to come home.
Tell us about, first of all, about the decision to give up practice in law in order to fulfill a little nudge that said you ought to be writing.
Well, I can certainly tell you, D.G., that aspiring writers don't really love my story because it's kind of akin to me waking up one morning and thinking, today I'm going to write a novel, and quitting my job and going to do it and actually making a career out of it. That is certainly atypical, and I would definitely say that, you know, one of the things in starting this venture was an appreciation for how saturated with talent is this industry and, you know, what a challenge it was going to be. But I just, from the very beginning, had always thought that I would be a writer at some point in my life. I guess I thought it would have to be after some nadir of great tragedy. And one day I just kind of realized that, you know, maybe I wasn't James Joyce and going to pound out Ulysses, but that I had something to say. And even if it was just funny or diverting, it was probably something that people could relate to. And I decided to take a chance on it.
Well, your mama, who's been a successful writer, not trained as a writer. How about you? Did you take writing courses in college or did you go to the all of the writing camps?
Absolutely
or did you just
not. I mean, I do not have any old dusty manuscripts. I had never taken a class or a course or a study and even tried writing until the day I sat down and wrote my first novel. I have, you know, I think letter writing. I was the email for me is sort of monumental because I, back in the day, was a prodigious letter writer. And for some reason, I had the foresight to keep them all. So I would write to friends, you know, long stories and humorous anecdotes about my life and my travels. And I photocopied them. So, you know, the precursor to the email and the, you know, the diary, I was keeping correspondence.
Did you write in longhand? Did you write on the computer or write type?
Longhand. I didn't even have a computer until I got to law school.
So you wrote longhand letters and didn't make carbons, but made copies.
Yeah,
you took advantage of some of the technological advances of the world, but not the fundamentals. And, oh, that's just interesting. So you had this notion that you didn't want to give up your descriptions of some of the things. You a substitute for a diary in some respects.
I think so, except for me, you know, I never was a diary keeper or journal writer because I think I need an audience in order to shape my expressions. Mm. So when I'm relating a story, I tell it to someone, and it's because I want to make them laugh. I want to entertain. I want to, you know, elicit a reaction. And, you know, the irony is that here I was doing this from a very young age, like fourth, fifth, sixth grade. And when I was a lawyer, one of the things I learned very early on is don't keep a diary.
Yeah.
I worked in the white-collar crime area, and I had clients ranging from Josh Steiner, who was a diary keeper in Whitewater, and Ron Brown, and FB, who's the Secretary of Agriculture. And they, except for Mr. Brown, they all got in trouble with diaries. And I had this sort of locked file cabinet of dangerous, toxic diaries that were causing these major white-collar crime investigations. So, you know, I definitely learned don't write down anything personal, but I do like to tell my stories.
That is such an interesting insight. We're trying to find out what to blame the collapse of the writing culture on, and we blamed it on the internet and on email, and what we really ought to blame it on is the justice system for teaching us that we can't keep diaries without them being subject
exposure.
To.
Yeah. Where the internet is a culprit, is it so easy to hit send? I mean, if we all don't have a recollection of an embarrassing reply all, then you haven't been on the internet very long.
No.
I think that more than anything curbs people's tendency to be familiar.
Well, we've all got our stories to tell about embarrassing moments on the internet, and sometimes it's when you get a message from one person and you won't afford it to your friend to say, what a jerk this guy is for writing this terrible, dumb email, just proves that he isn't worth anything. And then you hit the send button and you realize you, instead of forward, you'd hit reply.
Exactly.
And it's a crazy thing. I want to talk briefly about your books, and I want to do it in the context of something that you mentioned earlier, and that is that you thought some writers would be mad with you because you just stopped what you were doing. You'd never written a novel before. You wrote your first novel, and it got picked up by Avon, the HarperCollins imprint. And I've got two books in my hand. I guess, are you on for a series, or what is the deal on this? Tell us. I mean, all right, this story is going to make a lot of people jealous.
Okay.
Tell it anyway.
I will tell you that, I was practicing law, and I had been there about 6.5 years, and I was approached one day and sort of told that they were considering me for early partnership, that I was going to jump up onto partnership track.
This is in a big Washington law firm, a big Washington office of a big law firm.
Correct. Big Washington law firm. I had been doing lawyer lobbying. So as my ex used to call me, I was the scourge of the earth, lawyer and lobbyist. And but I liked my job. I don't go with the lawyer bashing very much because I found my job to be reasonably entertaining with challenging work surrounded by intelligent people who were pleasant to work with. You know, I never really felt that lawyering was this horrible job as stereotyped in film and
Well, I'm as a lawyer, or at least once a lawyer, I'm with you, and you have to confess that your dad was a lawyer, a very fine lawyer, and somebody who would be a pretty good model, so that
Correct.
You you wouldn't want to bash the law firm or the law profession based on the lawyer whom you knew best.
Well, and I'll tell you, you can actually blame my misdirection all on Earl Stanley Gardner and that legal maven Perry Mason, because. Oh. The silver-tongued Lothario of justice seduced me down the legal path.
Mm.
You know, when I was a kid, I would be the best days were sick days when I could watch marathons of black and white episodes where, you know, there'd be nearly hopeless cases and Perry Mason would demonstrate his client's innocence by exposing the real murder in like a gasp-inducing last-minute revelation. And
it was Perry Mason, not your dad.
Between the two of them, my dad does have a fine seersucker suit. So I followed him into law, and as did my brother. And I will say that when I defected from lawyer camp to writer camp, it was heralded with joyous open arms by my mother and my sister because it restored the balance of lawyers and non-lawyers in the family. And I kind of went into the Swiss neutral zone of half lawyer, half writer.
I love that. Well, tell us the story of or continue the story about how you were drawn away from the legal profession to writing and how that writing kind of worked out successfully pretty quickly.
Well, I went to law school right up the road at that other school.
And, we celebrate our connection with Duke. Don't worry about that.
So my beloved Duke, and I went back from my reunion shortly before this all happened, and I remember speaking to one of my favorite professors, and he said in a very surprised tone, "Oh, you're still practicing law?"
Oh, is that right?
And I was a little offended at the time. I thought, well, gosh, they haven't kicked me out of the system yet. But I think everyone saw that I wasn't going to stay forever in ways that even I didn't see. And so when I got this tap to accelerate the partner, I just started, gasping for air and didn't really love the idea of doing it for the rest of my life while I don't disparage the career, the profession. And my partner, who is a great mentor and friend, said to me, "Look, why don't you take a sabbatical?" Because I kind of said, oh, my God, I quit. And he said, whoa, let's just dial it down. And why don't you take a sabbatical and think about it? And so that was sort of radical for me. I'm not a big, snap decision maker. So I thought about it for a while, and I just decided that I would do this. And I can tell you that, the other thing that happened around the same time was that a storyline for my first book, Best Day of Someone Else's Life, kind of clicked together in my head, and I had a very complete beginning-to-end storyline. And so the combination of not wanting to continue on the path I was pursuing and having this idea suddenly, gel, led me to decide that I would just take the sabbatical and do it. And I'm not a big reader of the How to Write, Getting Started on Writing, Here's How to Write a Novel. But there is one book that's pretty good, and it's Stephen King's On Writing. And, he says two things that I 100% co-sign, and that is that there are two ways to be a writer, and only two, and that is to read and to write. And so I took a sabbatical, went out to Los Angeles because it was the most different place I could think of from where I was living in Washington, D.C. I lived on the beach, did yoga, and padded up to the local cafe, and I just started tapping keys.
You just started doing what?
Tapping keys.
Oh, tapping started keys. Okay. And you said you had kind of delivered miraculously, or at least suddenly, a storyline.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you what, let's do, Carrie Reichs. Let's take a break, and then let's come back and see how that storyline developed into your first novel, which I guess is The Best Day of Someone Else's Life. Is
right.
that right? Or
yeah.
Let's do that. Visiting with Carrie Reichs, and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Carrie Reichs, who is the author of two still new books. The what did I say, Carrie? It's not the old book, but it's not quite as new as the most recent book. It's a 2008 book, The Best Day of Someone Else's Life. And you were telling us how you left the law practice, had a storyline develop, and then, as you told me, I had to ask you what you were talking about, but you said you went back and started tapping keys.
Correct. Well,
now, that can't be all there is to it.
No. I mean, people do ask, how do you write a book? And as I was saying, I think that you need to read and you need to actually make the time to write. It's the only way to do it. And you can plot and plan and think and read help books. But honestly, just sitting down to write is the best way I know. And I think you also need some discipline. And this is one of the things that you talk to writers and they're all different. But the common thread is there is an amount of discipline in it. You know, I know people who have day jobs, so they get up and they work from 6 to 9 in the morning on their writing. I know other people who go into a cave for 3 weeks and do nothing but eat, sleep, and write, and that's it. And they can produce incredible work in short amounts of time. I think Stephen King wrote The Stand in 3 weeks. You know, and then there's people, my thing was I tend to work an 8-hour day, 5 days a week, and I discipline myself by pages. You know, I found the right cafe, and then I sat down, and as you know, my mom, Kathy Reichs, is a writer, and I said to her, so, you know, how many pages is a good day?
And oh.
She said 3 pages could be a good day, and, you know, I'm a little competitive, D.G., so I set my limit at 6. And so I write every day until I write 6 pages.
Now, that 6 pages, double space size, pike, 12 size, or what?
Yeah.
And how big are margins?
I write in single space, but the publishing industry only speaks in double space. So,
but
yes.
you're talking about single space pages.
I would try to pound out 6 pages.
Wow.
In single space. That's optimistic. So I would say double space pages is about where, you know, that's a good day.
That's incredible. That's incredible. And I guess the other thing that you try to sort writers out about is to what extent did your storyline guide your writing, and to what extent did you kind of give yourself freedom to go off on surprising, imaginative detours from your original storyline?
I think that will vary necessarily by genre. I mean, I tend to write, so if you are writing a very structured book like a mystery, you know, a whodunit, where there has to be clues, and, you know, I've worked on collaborating on writing an episode for a crime television drama, and it's very specific. You have to have this many suspects, this many misdirections, this one guilty party, and then there are these standards. And so if you're writing along those lines, I think you need much more discipline. If you're writing a mental reflection, personal character growth, human interaction, you might be a little more, let's just start writing and see what happens. I'm an ex-lawyer, so I am extremely outline-oriented. I tend to sit down and actually start writing when I know the beginning, middle, and end of my story. I know all my characters and their backstories, and I have a complete outline of plot direction. Now, having said that, in both of my books, once I start writing, surprising and interesting new, you know,
get different ideas. Yes. But same as a lawyer writing writing a brief.
Correct.
Would have his outline and would follow it pretty carefully, but then would get to a point where you would say, hey, I've got something else that fits here, or I see some other line that is going to be very other line of thinking that would be very persuasive. I'm going to figure out a way to work that in, or something like that.
Exactly. Although with the legal briefs, it wasn't always so exciting as with the novel.
Right.
I'd be like, "Hey, she's going to save someone's life right now." Didn't always happen that way. But well, you know, it is fun because I like very circular storylines. Not circular storylines. I guess an example would be Pulp Fiction, where you're watching different stories. But then at the end, suddenly you realize they're all interbraided in an interesting way, and they connect to each other.
They all come back together.
Exactly. So I like to have little storylines threaded throughout that at the end of the book, you're like, oh, aha, I see how this really redirects back to that. I didn't notice it at the time, but how neatly these parallel structures come together. And I really enjoy when I can tie that in. And sometimes I don't even realize I've done it until I get to the end, and then I'm like, oh my gosh, what a good job I did of that.
Well, Carrie Rice, tell us the storyline that popped into your head that ultimately became The Best Day of Someone Else's Life, your first published novel, published by Avon and imprint of HarperCollins. And what was that story? What was the storyline, and how detailed was it?
Okay, well, I'm originally from Charlotte, North Carolina, as you know, and I'm now living in Washington, D.C., and one thing that I'm fairly well known for is the number of weddings that I've attended. I have been to probably over 70 weddings. I have been the maid of honor 7 times, and I've been a bridesmaid and a reader even more times than that.
You're so kidding me? So you've got a whole – you do have a closet full. Like your character, you got a closet full of bridesmaid dresses.
Unwearable
again.
I do. And, you know, and I'm myself not married, and so I – I've been to all these weddings, and I found myself in a position of someone who just wasn't really sure that that was for me anymore. And, of course, I started out, as everyone does, with this starry-eyed idealization of the Mary tale, you know, the fantasy of the big white dress and the shiny, shiny shoes, and I couldn't wait for my turn. And I started thinking about that and how women really, before they are old enough to think outside the box, are just so socialized to desire this big day and this main event where they are the star of the parade. And that, you know, the groom, often his role is blurry and indistinct. You know, substitute groom here in your mind's eye of image of your wedding day. And so I, growing up in Washington, where you have a lot of single career women who are staying single longer, I just started thinking about that and how, you know, many women will hit a certain age in Charlotte. It could be around 26. You know, in D.C., it's around 36, where they just are like, now is the time to get married, and they'll clothesline the next guy that comes
along. Oh, come on. No, no, that's not really the way it works, is it? Is
well, it can. Not everyone.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just started trying to think about that. And so the story is really about someone who does start off idealizing her big day, and then as she matures and experiences other friends' wedding, realizing it's not for her. You know, and the message really isn't it is or isn't the right thing to do. It's that there's no one mold for all women.
So
we need to think what we want as opposed to just doing what we think we're supposed to want.
And so that was it. That was the idea. That was the storyline, but not the story.
Right.
And then help us, because this might be very instructive. And then how do you take that storyline and turn it into the very detailed outline that you talked about, that you're sort of lawyer-driven – that you were going to be very well organized, having not only the storyline there, but an outline of the characters and the backstories and everything else there. How did this idea turn into that? And you said you had all that in place before you started writing.
I did. So our storyline takes our main character, V Connolly, and she, you know, a couple things happen. She starts out in D.C., but she is a maid of honor 3 times back in North Carolina.
And what is V's real name?
V Connolly.
But what is her real name?
Oh, her real name is Kevin, because her parents thought they were having a boy. I thought you were trying to trick me into saying it was me.
No, but I knew, well, this is not fair, and this is kind of inside trick, but I've given my son a name that could be a girl's name.
Right, and me too. Carrie goes both
ways.
Yeah,
so,
well.
But, and you've got a name that could be Carrie. It could, you don't know for sure when you hear Carrie whether you're talking about a boy, but they're... as you point out, Kevin is identified as a boy's name. Carrie is, what would you call it? It's not ambidextrous. Gender neutral.
Yeah,
right. And our Greer is, that's a gender neutral game name, I guess. And so you...
I'll tell you, I missed a big opportunity when I was in high school because I was admitted to Carolina as a boy and put into a boy's dorm.
Is that right? So you really were. You should have, you know, many young women would have jumped at the chance.
A whole different college experience.
Oh, that's terrific. Well, anyway, I interrupted. You're talking about Vi.
Okay. Vi or V, whichever people prefer. She comes back to Charlotte and she's maid of honor in these weddings and you know, she kind of realizes that she doesn't really fit into the person that she was when she left town. But, you know, she's still a little bit sort of sad that she's not going through this herself and hankering for her own big day and kind of falls into an old relationship that's being retread. But, you know, it's comfortable. And one she always visualized going to the altar in her romantic youth. But as she gets more pulled into other people's weddings, she starts to feel that it's very much of a commercial endeavor and moves away from the idea of just cherished every day. And she starts to believe, look, you know, by choosing the person I'm with every day and not by defaulting, you know, because we're man and wife, I think the relationship will be healthier. So she decides she doesn't really believe in marriage. And then she, of course, meets someone who's very traditional, Irish Catholic, and they're in a relationship. And it starts to look at more adult situations like compromise and how much can you compromise before you become so compromised that the relationship is no longer healthy.
Well. Well, did you think about this when you had the story idea? You said, I'm going to write this for old people like DG and my daddy, or am I going to write it for teenagers? Am I going to write it for people my age, young people, but adults? How did you think about your market?
I think this is a story that anyone can relate to because anyone who's ever been to a wedding can appreciate the humor of the bride gone mad. I mean, if you just turn on the television, there are 50 television programs having to deal with bridezillas and saying yes to the dress and, you know, craziness. You know, what I did is I took a common theme that the reason it's so recurrent is because it is resonant with everyone, you know, not just women, but men. And I retreaded it a little bit. Like, I basically said, okay, here's my 27 dresses, except I don't feel that at the end of the day, our heroine is fulfilled simply by getting married on a beach at sunset, that she's got a lot more depth and complexity, and there isn't just one answer to happiness, that getting married on a beach does not solve all your problems, that you really need to grow as a person and know who you are and what you want for happiness.
Well, what does your publisher tell you about who's reading it and who they kind of nudge you to write for?
Well, I tend to write for, in all my books, women who are slightly out of step with standard social expectations. So I tend to try to take a look at the ways that we, because I've lived a very different life myself, you know, unusual, several careers, lots of traveling, very independent. And I just look at sort of the choices that I had to make to do that, having children later in life, you know, not going down the traditional wedding route. And how does that make me feel vis-a-vis my colleagues? But at the same time, it's merely a choice. It's no judgment on any one way of being. I think it's everyone needs to find what suits them. And that's, I guess, the repeated message to any male, female, old, young, is you're always trying to figure out how you fit in with what's expected of you. And it's often difficult to turn down the noise of social programming, whether it's from upbringing, religion, culture, pop culture, to kind of look inside and let your own garden tell you, you know, what is the right answer for you. And that never stops. And so hopefully the appeal of this book is that anyone can be going through that journey at any time.
How did you get this book published?
Well, you know, to circle back to a question you asked earlier about how do I go from being a lawyer to writer, a lot of cutting is the answer because my 6 pages plus 6 pages plus 6 pages ended up being 500 some odd pages. It was ridiculously long.
Well, I'm interested. I shouldn't interrupt you because I'm interested in what you're saying. But the question I was thinking in the how that you have an inroads into the publishing world. You know how agents work and all of this because of your mom's success. But at the same time, that doesn't carry you across the goal line. But you probably did have an opening at least to send your work to an agent.
Absolutely.
Tell us the story from there.
Well, clearly barriers to entry are the greatest thing, the greatest obstacle to receiving recognition as a writer and becoming professionally employed. And I had the advantage that my mother had a longtime agent who had known me for some time. And when I decided to do this, was incredibly supportive throughout and said to me, when you have something for me to look at, you know, bring it to me. I will take a look at it, because most agents will not accept unsolicited manuscripts.
Right, right, right.
So I did. And obviously she was not going to represent me. It would amount to a conflict of interest. And so
why would it be a conflict of interest?
Well, my mother, who, as you know, writes murder mysteries, has long advocated that we collaborate on an endeavor. She's constantly pushing me to put a dead body in my book so that we can work together. I haven't quite gotten there yet, but if she keeps asking, there might be a dead body somewhere. So if we ever were to work together, just professionally, we would need independent representation to negotiate the contract. So with an eye to potentially working together in the long term, we just from the very beginning.
So even though you're in the same family, well, you're a lawyer, you understand this, that you would have to have somebody separate as you and your mother divided up the pie, even though you all reached an agreement in advance, you would need a separate, maybe separate lawyers, but separate agents?
I don't even know separate lawyers so much. We probably use the same counsel within the agency, but the agents do everything. So you really would need a separate agent thinking about what's best for you, because what would be professionally in the interest of one writer might not be in the interest of the other writer. And I don't know that I would be savvy enough to always know that, and the agents in their expertise would really be focused on the genre and the career path of their individual client.
You know, what I thought was that your mama's agent would have said, look, I like to do everything, but basically my interest is in, you know, turn the page crime novels, and your mama's the expert at that, and I can represent her. You're doing a little bit different thing, and I've got some agents who might be better than I am at that, at representing somebody in that genre. But in any event, she sent you to another agent.
She did. Well, I'll say that with agents, genre is very important because it's all about the relationship. So for them, it behooves you to be with an agent who specializes in your area, because they know which publishers to direct the manuscript. And they have the relationships with those imprints and publishers most suited to what you've done. Now, having said that, my mother's agent is a powerhouse, and I'm in awe of her. And she could represent anyone she wanted, call anyone she wanted, and I was just too small of a fish. You know, she loves me personally, but I need to write something, you know, that's going to get on Oprah before she's going to, you know, venture any compromise of representation of two potentially conflicting writers. So she passed it on to a woman in her agency who was more focused in my genre. And after that, it was on my own. I was lucky enough that the woman, her name was Lisa, read my book and was very happy to represent me. And so what we did next was actually she worked with me closely to trim it down. It was a little too rough to shop around to editors and publishers at that point because it was overlong. And so we worked significantly on editing it down, and then we sent it out to, I think, about 12 publishers, and I sold it in 3 weeks.
Wow.
And for my sake, I sold it to a different publishing house than my mom had published with, which for my credibility and you know, claims of nepotism is very helpful.
Yeah, that's got to be very satisfying.
Completely independent, right. Yeah.
Well, we're visiting with Carrie Reichs about her two latest, newest, and first novels, and we'll continue that conversation after this short break.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Carrie Reichs. Carrie is a Charlotte native, a Duke Law graduate, practiced law in a high-powered Washington-based law firm, or Washington law firm, did lobbying as well as a lot of legal work. And then took a sabbatical, which continues to this day. The results have been two published novels by HarperCollins imprint Avon. The latest book is called Leaving Unknown, and Carrie Reichs, it's quite different from your first book.
It is.
It's a Chaucer's book, right? It's a travel tale.
It is a travel tale, both internally and externally. It opens up in Charlotte, North Carolina.
I have to say, it's the title for people who want to write it down is "Leaving Unknown,"
correct.
And this is really a new book. It's a 2010 book.
It is a 2010 book. Just came out in the spring or early summer, I guess, spring. And it takes the little sister of our family that we met in my first book, Best Day of Someone Else's Life. And Maeve Connolly is the younger, fairly flighty sister of the narrator of my earliest book. And we join her after an extended stay in college. She's taken 7 years to finish up and more majors than most people can count.
Where did you send her to school?
I sent her to UNCC right here in Charlotte.
Uh-huh.
And but she, you know, she'd sampled one or two others before settling there. And so, you know, generally you have someone who's a bit of a hypochondriac, who's got the you know, fiscal woes of a third world nation and is not very focused. And we join her, she's just finally finished school, but she's found herself in a bit of a pickle. She's lost her most recent job and gotten cut off by her family. And so she decides she's going to prove everybody wrong, that she's not a flitterdibbit, and she's going to drive across country.
Now, does her family give up on her because she's lackadaisical in school, or she just isn't focused, how does this breakup occur?
I think there's a little tough love there, and they just sort of feel that it's unhealthy for them to continue bailing her out of her habit to console her troubles by purchasing shoes and, you know, frivolous items. So they just sort of want her, they desperately want to support her and get her back on her feet. And you kind of know from the beginning that Maeve isn't your typical post-collegiate slacker, that there's something going on there, that she's been knocked off her rails, and there's some past incident.
And that's something we're going to learn later on as we read
correct.
Through the book. But we don't know what that is right now.
Correct. And you do know that she's lost her best friend. Her best friend has died, and you don't know much about that, but you do know that she's not really dealing with it very well. So her parents know she's been through a hard time, but they make the difficult decision that, you know, really kind of being strict with her is going to be most beneficial in the long run.
Well, tell us about this road trip, and what's the theme? What is the theme of the road trip?
The theme of the road trip is a bit scattered. You know, she starts out, as I must say I did, I've driven cross-country about 7 times, either solo or with my 2 cats, which is another novel all by itself, with the theory that if you have a good map, plenty of water, and a blanket, you'll be fine. And it's a little more complicated than that. I've learned through trial by fire. For example, I have learned that if you're in the middle of West Texas and you decide that you're going to push on through 2 hours to the next town, you better call ahead, because otherwise you may find that there's no room at the inn. In which case, you can sleep comfortably in a Mini Cooper convertible.
Yeah, I read
but
that.
But it's not
that.
Advisable.
Yeah, I think more accurately, you put it in your written materials that you could sleep in a Mini. But I didn't read the word comfortably.
Okay, that's a fair point. And I'm not that tall. So, but so she does start this road trip. And for her, she's, you know, venturing across in a 1970 Plymouth Roadrunner. It's a bit of a decrepit but beloved old car that is prone to spontaneous and exciting failure to operate and running out of gas and various other hijinks that, you know, put Maeve in interesting situations.
So you get stuck having to change tires or something in a
exactly.
out-of-the-way place.
Among many, many other little tricks.
Well, now, what's the point of all this in your book?
Well, you know, it just takes her off the beaten track. She is a very strong, initiative-filled woman who, you know, while she starts out seeming to let life happen to her, once you see her on this road trip, you realize that when forced by circumstances to be inventive, you know, ingenious, and take command, she does. And so you really start to see her blossom on these byways of America as she chases down these strangely named towns. So she's, you know, you have two things going on here. You're seeing her develop as a person, but you're also seeing her chasing something she doesn't even know what it is.
Well, now, did she start it? When I asked about the theme, I was interested in the names of the OK Oklahoma and
sure,
Frog Burp or whatever it is. Give us some of the names. And did she set out to visit the names of the strangest name towns?
She does. She is, you know, very fond of the backroads of America. She, living in North Carolina, had traveled all around, you know, starting with a town called Half Hell, North Carolina, she just became intrigued and fascinated by, you know, North Carolina offers Climax, Toast, Erect, Welcome, Why Not? You know, you can cross over to South Carolina to 96 or Sugar Pit. And, you know, she just wants to go see these places and see what they're all about. And it's kind of a, does the reality match the illusion, you know, there? And constantly chasing these interesting detours to see what's there. And, you know, in some ways, this is the beginning of her reawakening from somewhat of a stupor that she's been in since college as she chases them across the country, and how she ends up in unknown, which is way out of the way in deep southern Arizona, unknown Arizona. And she goes down to check it out, and that's where her car breaks down in a pretty final way and leaves her on a much more extended rest stop than she planned.
Well, it's quite clear to me that that you share with your heroine in this book an interest in, I mean, that you, let me put it this way, that the travel by yourself across America is something that has been a life-altering or a life-enriching experience for you, even though it might be tough. But there's more to the book than that shared appreciation for what travel across the country on your own can do for you, isn't there?
Absolutely.
And what is it?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things, among others, I've been very interested in cancer issues and survivorship issues. And Maeve has lost her friend and, you know, is struggling to deal with it. And so often we have a very black and white view of victim and survivorship, and we are sympathetic for the victims and we are joyous for the survivors. But survivorship is very complex.
I want to take a break and come back and talk just about that topic.
Okay.
We're visiting with Kathy Reichs, with Carrie Reichs, the daughter of Kathy Reichs, the very successful North Carolina crime novelist. But Carrie Reichs is an author in her own right, and we're going to talk more about that after this short break.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I've been visiting with Carrie Reichs, who's the author of two new books, The Best Day of Someone Else's Life and Leaving Unknown. We've been talking about Leaving Unknown, Carrie Reichs, and it's sort of a journey book, like Chaucer's or Traveling with Charlie or all of these great travel books across the country. But before the break, you said there's more to the book than that.
Imagine the dull thud with which my agent received my pronouncement that I was going to write a comedy about cancer. But, you know, that's the way it came down. I looked at Maeve's journey, and as she struggles to come to terms with the loss of her best friend to leukemia and, you know, her own issues, it strikes that there's survivorship is such a complex and interesting journey in and of itself, and it's not so simple as, you know, how lucky are you? You often have to learn how to overcome survivor's guilt, pick up the pieces, you know, accept that you're going to live and go on, and accept that you'll never be the person you might have been but for, and figure out who you are and put the pieces together and go with that, you know. And the other thing is the humor part is laughing, and even in our darkest personal trials, that if you can't laugh, then, you know, it's going to be much harder for you to push through. And so I think that, you know, living is laughing and breathing. And my experience with cancer survivors and losing, you know, a dear child to cancer changed my life. And I wanted to write a book that captured some of those feelings and ultimately focuses on someone who really learns how to seize the best of what she learned and then move forward with her life. You know, take baby steps into stronger steps into becoming, you know, an adult as an adolescent survivor and seizing control of her life and loving it again.
I've told you that one of my standard questions is, who did you dedicate the book to and why? And you got an answer for this one, I guess, that's consistent with what
we're talking about. The book is dedicated to a girl named Dana Rodero. She was diagnosed with leukemia when she was 5 years old and put in the good fight until she was 10. And she didn't survive her bout, unfortunately. And through that, I became involved with the Leukemia Lymphoma Society's Human Training Program designed to raise money for leukemia research. And I've met just the most remarkable array of survivors and people, and it really brought my attention to the ripple effect that a single diagnosis can have among friends, family, and community. And I really wanted to capture that story and that experience and do it through the eyes of a woman who's just got this incredible joie de vivre, and how she comes to terms with the, you know, that that's okay, and that she can be strong and want a life, and it doesn't compromise the feelings that she had in the loss of her friend and the struggle to be as part of that diagnosis community.
Well, on your dedication page, you also talk about some of the national chapter and the greater Los Angeles chapter events.
Correct.
And training
I believe it or not, bike 100 miles in one day on a regular basis to raise money for Leukemia Lymphoma Society, well, which has a lot of my friends who knew me growing up scratching their heads like, I'm going to what? I'm not the most athletic person, but it is something I'm grateful that I can do every day. And I can assure you that biking around Lake Tahoe is probably a little easier than Maeve's journey across country in a car with a foul-mouthed talking bird, just her only companion, her pet Oliver. I don't know which would be harder, to be honest.
Well, Carrie Rice, what a great thrill to chat with you about your books and about your life. And we're glad you're back in North Carolina for a visit with your family, and especially with your mom, Kathy Rice. I know she's got to be very, very proud of you.
Oh, she's excited. I think that she's far more impressed with her new grandson than she is all the books I could ever write. But, you know, I'll take it.
Thanks, Carrie Rice. Thanks to all y'all for listening. And this is D.G. Martin with Who's Talking. We'll be right back here soon.